Cecil Bothwell was elected to Asheville City Council in 2009, open atheist. He's the author of 8 books, including a critical political biography of Billy Graham, and most recently, Whale Falls, An Exploration of Belief and Its Consequences. Please welcome Cecil Bothwell.
Thank you for welcoming me here, and it's somewhat daunting to follow these 2 speakers and so many great speakers this weekend. I really am enormously pleased to have been here to experience such great interactions, both in the sessions and with all of you individually as we bumped into each other. It's really inspiring. I came into politics after a career in building and then a career in writing and editing, where I became an investigative reporter. And little did I know that my investigative work would lead to controversy that has really fundamentally shifted what I do with my life. In my research concerning belief systems in North America, I've discovered there's a sect known as the American Atheists, who are a highly superstitious lot. They base their anti-religious year on the lunar month, beginning with a theoretically determined new moon falling in the 29-day period from March 8th to April 5th inclusive, which is dedicated as the highly unholy atheist lunar month for the year. And then the annual feast date is the third Saturday in the highly unholy atheist lunar month, or in other words, the Saturday after the highly unholy atheist lunar month's 14th day. The 14th day of the highly unholy atheist lunar month is designated by convention as the highly unholy atheist full moon, although the 14th of the lunar month may differ from the date of the astronomical full moon. I mean, it begins to sound a lot like paganism. Humanists are somewhat more rational. They have their annual feast day on one of the 2 Saturdays in the secular holiday known as spring break. Unless, of course, it conflicts with the aforementioned highly unholy atheist feast. You know, when you describe Easter that way, and of course the atheists choose Easter because hotels are cheap at that time of year, and that's why it's so late in April this year. You know, when you describe it that way, it sounds, oh wow, how can anybody believe that? And yet, of course, we run our secular calendar around the religious calendar in many, many ways. My sweetheart has a 12-year-old daughter who, and therefore, has to deal with school schedules. And in Asheville, we're in the north part of the South, or also a liberal part of the South, but we have snow days. And the snow days piled up this year, and suddenly the religious calendar becomes a big issue. Were they going to have to go to school on Good Friday? In fact, they chose to do so. So the needs of state funding, which require a certain number of hours per day and a certain number of days per year to get money from Raleigh, North Carolina, overcame the religious need to celebrate Good Friday by being out of school on that day. And of course, because Easter wobbles, it affects my sweetheart, her father, she's separated from the father of her daughter, which is why we're involved. And the court has ordered a set schedule of child sharing because they have shared custody. Well, when Easter doesn't fall in spring break week, then suddenly something the court forgot to mention comes up, which is who gets Easter? They're told who gets 4th of July, who gets Thanksgiving, who gets Christmas each year. I mean, it's all set in stone except Easter and spring break. And somehow spring break, when it wobbles as compared to Easter, it throws all kinds of complications. It may lead to a court case this year. And it's, you know, it's funny, but it's also the reality that we've allowed religion or have permitted religion to stick with our calendar through all these years. And as Sean very clearly laid out, there are many, many ways that religion intrudes into education. A big one in North Carolina these days is abstinence education. The GOP took over our state house in the 2010 election, and they're pushing hard for abstinence-only education, sex education, or none whatsoever, because they're cutting the budget. And really, they just assume have no sex education at all, since people are perfectly able to learn at home in their spare time. And in that regard, I find it interesting that a study that was out this last year. There, I'm back on. A study that was out this last year showed that in red states across the country, there's higher teen pregnancy rates, and, pretty generally, and so that suggests that this failure to educate may have some effect on life choices for our young people throughout their lives. Another area that is highly affected is abortion. Due to the conservatism of our surrounding states, for those of you who aren't familiar with North Carolina geography, Asheville is located in the little thin tail end of the state out toward the west. And we're surrounded to the north by Tennessee, to the south by Georgia and South Carolina. And there are no abortion services in those surrounding states. So our two clinics in Asheville are the only source of abortions for quite a wide area. And so we have people coming in there from hundreds of miles away. I've been a clinic escort for 5 years now. I go there once a month. I go there once a month to interfere with the people with the loudspeakers and the grotesque Photoshop signs with the, you know, just grotesque pictures, inflicting real pain on women who have had a terrible choice to face. And I see that because there's an additional problem imposed because of this travel time necessary. People are leaving at like 2 a.m. from their homes to get there on time on a Saturday morning. And there's a move afoot to try to force a consultation with the doctor some period of time before an abortion is performed. And that would impose the same trip twice on women who have to. So over and over again, the whole area of abortion issues comes to the fore and causes real world problems. And the thing is, when I get out in the counties around me and talk to people, well, they're kind of against abortion. They kind of think morally that's not a good thing. I think they should be rare. I think if safe, legal, and rare. But if their own daughter gets pregnant in high school, then suddenly there's a real large interest there. It kind of reminds me of my dad, who was a really devoted Republican all his life, and fairly right-wing and really happy about Reagan and so forth. But he developed Parkinson's late in life. And he finally voted for Bill Clinton because Bill Clinton was for stem cell research, which had showed some promise in treating Parkinson's disease. So when it comes home to roost, people often realize that their self-interest may not be served by ideology that they've embraced for a long period of time. Out in Asheville, we had a common practice at football games, especially out in the county, it's not so much in the city, that there was a prayer at the beginning of each football game. They'd all, you know, the players would kneel on the field and the minister would say a prayer. And I often wondered, you know, how did they think that was worthwhile, since one or the other team won, and I assume they were all praying to win. But that was... it went to court. Somebody took it to court and found that it was not legal to have that imposed religious service at the beginning of public football games. And that led to the We Still Pray movement in the United States, where a local Baptist church in our area started printing these bumper stickers that said We Still Pray as a protest to that. And I think that spread widely. I don't know how far, but I see the stickers all over the southern region anyway. Well, Asheville being Asheville, which is... we sometimes think of ourselves as the Paris of the South or the Austin of the East. immediately, bumper stickers saying, "We still read," started. And then, I don't know what your town does, but we have a big urban chicken movement. The people who want to raise backyard flocks as part of relocalizing agriculture, and their bumper stickers are, "We still lay." Then again, shortly thereafter, last year, I guess it was, the Freedom for Religion Foundation put up billboards in North Carolina in conjunction with the Triangle Free Thought Society that said, "One Nation Indivisible." And immediately a billboard campaign appeared across, starting emanating from Asheville, as I understand it, a group in Asheville, One Nation Under God, or I think it just said Under God with an American Eagle on there. And again, just lately, the Triangle Free Thought Society, in conjunction with the Freedom From Religion Foundation, has done another billboard campaign around our state capitol with pictures of atheists and humanists showing that they're normal people. A truck driver, a family, a nuclear family, you know, this is what an atheist family looks like, to educate the people of the state. We haven't had long enough yet to have a reaction, as far as I know, to that in the state. But I think it's pretty cool that in a state that's considered to be part of the Bible Belt, the secular and atheist movement, and the humanist movement, is showing real strength. People get it. You know, when we speak to the real needs of people, to the kind of things that both the previous speakers were talking about, the ways that humanism addresses our common needs, people begin to understand it. One of the changes that's occurred, some of you, I'll briefly recount this, some of you know my history. I was elected to council, and my book on Billy Graham became an issue during the election. In the afterword to that book, I had said that I knew that writing this critical biography, it's a political biography, whatever he wants to believe is up to Billy. I said I knew that I would probably be branded as Satan's helper or worse for writing this book. And one of the smear letters that got mailed out said I was a self-professed Satan's helper. And then the next smear letter that went out said that I had claimed that Billy Graham was influenced by Adolf Hitler. And at the polls on the election day, my campaign manager was there, and one of the voters came up to her and said, "I'm not voting for that Bothwell. He said Billy was influenced by Adolf Hitler." And she said, "Well, yeah, that's in his book, and his source was Billy Graham's autobiography." "Yeah, who wrote that?" Those smear letters had some effect. These were warning people that they were about to elect a non-theist to city council. And I fell from first in the primary election. It's an open primary. I was first of 10 candidates. I came in third in the general, but there were three seats, so I picked up a seat. And then they tried to use the our version of the medieval, what do you call it? The medieval rubble in the Constitution of England. We had medieval rubble in North Carolina's Constitution, too, in that it says you can't hold public office if you shall deny the being of Almighty God. And they tried, a couple of people, actually turned out to be white supremacists, tried to enforce that against me to keep me from being sworn into office. That led to national and international press attention during the second week of December in 2009, which completely took me by surprise. I mean, here I'm on city council, first term in a town of about 80,000 now under the current census. It was an attention that was completely unexpected. Nothing I would be accorded in that position. I mean, we're a small town. But it lent me a platform that I didn't expect either. It's the reason I'm speaking here today. It's the reason I was at the American Atheist Convention last year, where they dubbed me the most courageous elected official of either 2009 or 2010, I wasn't real clear which it was, but I welcome that attention. You know, we all have egos. But what was more important was the attention to my work as a biographer and the research I've done in the past and the way it has galvanized me to work on secular issues. Whereas before it was kind of a sidebar to my life, it's become now a really important piece of the work I want to do going forward. As was mentioned, I've announced my candidacy for Congress in the North Carolina 11th District. which demonstrates a lot of gall for a first-term city council member. And as one of my friends in the audience reminded me yesterday, there is a lot of ego involved in that. I think none of us who run for office would stand for office unless we had a pretty good impression of ourselves. And I'll confess, you know, that I think I could do the job. But it seems to me we all need to step up in whatever way we can to defend our beliefs, to make it clear that we exist out there. There's a lot of us out there. A poll last year showed that most people do not place God as the main reason they go to church, most churchgoers. They go for the social aspects. They go for the improvement in their children's moral outlook. They go for the potlucks, but God is down the list. And so it doesn't much matter to me, well, it matters some to me, if I win or lose this upcoming election. That's in November 2012, it's a ways off. I'm starting early to build a grassroots group. But if I advance the cause, if I advance the cause of social justice, I will have made a mark. I will have moved the ball forward in the same way that so many who have gone before have moved the ball forward. Interestingly, again, I'm in the Bible Belt, although I call Asheville the diamond on the buckle of the Bible Belt. I've had a chance as a council member to interact with county office holders in the region. And because we're a 15-county district out there, it's very thinly populated outside of Asheville. And I've had a number of elected officials sidle up to me at meetings and say, you know, I agree with you. But I could never say that publicly. Well, we can make room for people to say it publicly. We can make room in our churches. I mean, I'm an active member of the Unitarian Universalist Church. In Asheville, we have an atheist minister, and it's a very non-theist church. And churches are able to get into places and do things that because of their size, because of the body of bodies, we even have political influence. We write letters to elected officials. A collection of churches in our town, an interfaith alliance with which I've been very active, with some Church of Christ people, with a non-denominational church called Jubilee, with a Jewish synagogue, with Christians United Christians United for the Community, which is a number of black churches that have gotten together. We all worked together to pass a domestic partner benefit program in Asheville in the city council so that same-sex couples, one of whom works for the city of Asheville, will be able to get the same benefit for their partners that we accord to married couples. That's the kind of strength the churches have. The churches were able to get together and convince the other elected officials that it was safe to go there. And at the same time, we passed a resolution urging our state legislature to enact a gay marriage law, or at least not to ban, or not to define marriage as between one man and one woman, which the Republicans are working very hard to do. So again, there's strength in those churches, and when we can align with churches, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, the truth is, you know, we all choose to believe what we choose to believe for whatever reason we choose it. We tend to think in terms of that we're in the reality-based community, that we reach our decisions rationally, and yet even those rational decisions have subjective elements to them. And to deny that, I think it would be foolish. And so when we find that these other people in our communities reach different decisions about pretty principally where we came from and where we're going, and whether we survived death or not, the truth of the matter is, from my perspective, I don't think so, but you know, until I blink out here, I don't really know for sure. I mean, not getting into too heated an argument with those people over those kind of issues allows us to work together on the social justice issues, and I think that's pretty important, because the churches are powerful, and when you find liberal ministers who are willing to work with you, work with them. You know, it can be part of humanizing politics in America. I'll conclude with a little bit of a vignette about Billy Graham, because that's my one area of sort of professional expertise that relates to our movement. In 2002, I read a quote from one of the Nixon tapes that was released in March of 2002 that showed Billy Graham trashing the Jews in a conversation with Nixon in the Oval Office. And as reported by the Associated Press, it sounded like it was a brief exchange, a few words back and forth. Graham's PR machine kicked into gear. It immediately denied everything. Graham said he didn't remember ever having said that. Interesting to deny a piece of tape. He certainly didn't feel that way. But I knew as a reporter for several years at that point that there was more, an AP story of two paragraphs probably had more story behind it. So I obtained the original transcript and a copy of the tape and the transcript, found that the conversation had gone on for an hour and a half and that Graham had consistently been leading the conversation through much of it, trashing the Jews, calling them that they were satanic Jews that were destroying the country, and telling Nixon that maybe we could do something about it after your re-election. 1972, which is a pretty ominous sort of thing. We heard about other people in history doing something about Jews after elections. So I decided to look into it and was shocked to discover that the supposed spiritual advice that Graham had delivered to presidents for all these years, we keep hearing, he counsels them in times of trouble. He was advocating for war over and over and over again. He believed that the Christian armies of America would Christianize the world. He wanted Truman to go into Korea before Korea exploded as an issue. He wanted Eisenhower to go into Indochina, which we later knew as Vietnam. He counseled Johnson and went to rally the troops for Lyndon Johnson. He even advocated genocide during the Nixon administration in Vietnam. It was not the story we've been told before. And a corollary story that really came to light as I studied what he'd done is that he is the one who kicked open the door that used to block that used to bar the combination of church and state in America. We held to the separation pretty clearly through World War II. There were no prayers in Congress. There was no prayer on the church on the Capitol steps. We didn't have in God We Trust on our paper money, and of course we didn't have under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. It all happened starting in 1949, 1950. Leading up through the McCarthy era, when the anti-communist fear-mongering led to the insertion of God into our public language. Graham introduced the prayer breakfasts. Graham got an act of Congress to have the first crusade on the steps of the Capitol. And through his fairly gentle public appearance, he wasn't like Falwell, he wasn't like Robertson, he wasn't alarming to many people. He intruded religion into government slowly and steadily, which led to a person like Ronald Reagan, who was an agnostic when he was a union organizer in California, but he saw his chance to take advantage of the religious support that Jimmy Carter had enjoyed, and he carved inside of Jimmy Carter into the southern states, again as part of a follow-up to the Nixon Southern strategy, which used the racism card to turn former Democrats in the South toward the Republican Party. And very opportunistically, Reagan suddenly was religious, and he endorsed the ministers. And since then, we've seen what happened. But I think we can trace a lot of that back to the power of Billy Graham and the enormous financial empire he's constructed, which reaches into every corner of our country and the world. And you'll hear later this morning from Jeff Charlotte, who wrote the book about the family, and has done a lot of other research concerning the religious movement in Washington. I was at the Billy Graham Library in Wheaton, Illinois, doing my research, apparently at about the same time that Jeff Charlotte was at the same library doing his research about the family. And I was sorry I hadn't met him at that point. I hope to meet him today. But Graham has the archives for the family in the Wheaton archives for the Billy Graham Association. That's how closely tied they are. And they've done some really, really, to my mind, horrendous things, including Uganda, where that group has had an effect, has been part of the effort to impose the death penalty on homosexuals. I mean, these are not kind and gentle Christians. They are sword and fire Christians that are leading that effort. So I look forward to learning more from all of you in coming months. I need to figure out what's the best way to present a secular candidacy in the Bible Belt. I've been encouraged that I did this last week. A Baptist minister came to tell me he's supporting me because Baptists believe in no intercession between humans and God, and therefore separation of church and state is extremely important to many Baptists. I had a Mormon woman phone me who says that Mormons have been terribly affected by religious persecution, and the church, the Mormon churches in Western North Carolina want to get behind me. You can never tell where your bedfellows are going to come from in politics. So thank you for listening. I look forward to talking to you after this event.